Good morning again. I hope you've been able to worship God in spirit and truth today. Hope you haven't been struck with the giggles like I have for most of the service. I've been amused and distracted. I'm sorry if I just seem distracted down the front row. Four things have distracted me this morning. Number one, it's not so much the castle or the decorations. It's just I keep thinking, if I could preach from that turret up at the top, how much more authoritative I would be looking down at you. So that makes me laugh every time I looked up. And then the peace sign that kept jabbing Ronnie in the side every time he'd sway to the right. I kept thinking, this will be the time when it's going to fall over. So I've moved it. You're okay now, Ronnie. And then Ed, first his picture of his arms folded at his first Restore. That could have been the first picture of me at Restore. Just, this is not how we do it. But I'm so glad I still go. But the best one, bud, that distracted me the most was when Ed described one of my first sermons here. Ed, who has worked here so many years and known my predecessor, Bud Ross, so well. Ed, who has breakfast with Bud and I on a regular basis, described me as, well, we've got an upgrade. And I thought, that's going to make breakfast so awkward this week. So I've giggled all through worship. I don't know if I'm going to preach or not. I'm going to try. We're going to try, if I can get through it, to finish our series today on the subject of the strong man, looking at some images of Jesus and his compelling strength from the book of Mark's gospel. And each time we've started out with the same quotation from chapter 3, where Jesus is being questioned and it's being suggested that maybe he's casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub. And he says, listen, you don't get to rob the strong man unless you tie up the strong man. Jesus, with a kind of casual remark, says, I came here knowing full well what I was up against. And in this simple statement, I intend to bind the strong man, he tells us that he believes he has power sufficient to the task. And so in these lessons, we've been seeing in Mark the little glimpses of the power of Jesus over the evils in our world. But I saved what I thought was the toughest for last this week. And that is this question, is Jesus strong enough to win the final battle, the one we all fear? Everything else in the grand scheme of things is a little bit small potatoes when it comes to our fear, when it comes to death. Been doing some research lately for academic purposes as well, and stumbled across a quote from a neurosurgeon named Sam Harris, who's an atheist and is one of these fellows who writes a lot of best-selling books. He's always trying to make the case that you can be moral without religion, without God. He's a very fascinating author, wrong about everything, but very interesting. But one of his quotes that I stumbled across the other day was, he says, you know, all religion is just a frantic overreaction to the fear of death. And when I look at the world, I guess I see it a little differently, that I see most of human life as a frantic overreaction to the fear of death. That we spend a lot of our times trying to distract ourselves from our own mortality. I don't mean in religion. In fact, in religion, we're more honest about it than maybe anywhere else in public life. Where else this week can you go and find a few hundred people sitting around thinking for 30 minutes about dying? We don't do that. It's an uncomfortable topic. You're not going to do that at the Rotary Club. Death is, in fact, one of the last great taboos. We just don't talk about it. And in Christianity, we do concern ourselves with it because it's going to happen. And if you don't concern yourself with it, you're missing something in your estimation of how you should live your life because it is a fact. But I don't see frantic fear. I see something else. I see people who understand what the lesson today is hopefully about, which is the power God has over death. Why is it that death does frighten us so much? And there's an answer for that I think is fairly simple. Paul hints at it in a passage I want to return to at the end in 1 Corinthians 15:26, and he says, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. I think one of the reasons that we are the most fearful of it is its finality and that we haven't seen it yet. Everyone knows we'll get there. No one who can talk to us has been there so far. It's the bully at the end of the street, and we know we're going to get there eventually, but we haven't got there yet. We've had brushes with death. We've had sickness and accidents and other things. We've had a whole 15-month stretch of living with human mortality on a grand scale. But it's still out there. And if I'm being really painfully honest, deep down inside, we know that we don't actually know how that's going to work out until it's too late. And what I mean by that is, I'm not trying to be a cynic or a skeptic. I'm really not. I'm not trying to preach doubt. But what I'm saying is, if Christians are wrong, we're going to find out when it's all over, right? If death is the end, no life thereafter, no spirit, no soul, no resurrection, nor world to come, no heaven and earth or nothing. If that's just the end, and as Richard Dawkins sometimes says, you're dead like Rover, dead all over. I mean, when you're done, that's it. Dust in the universe. You won't even be around to know about it. So in other words, Christian hope, it's the last thing as an empirical scientist I can't verify. I can't show you a sample of 300,000 resurrected people who will never taste of death again and say, see, that's how it works. I can show you people getting better from illnesses. I can show you people living a Christian life and having that make a difference. I can show you the victory of God in lots of places in your life. But I'm not going to be able to show you God defeating death until God defeats death. And so there's a part of me, and I think of all of us, that lives in a little bit of suspense about that, no matter how much faith we have, that we look and we say, I sure hope we're right about that one, because we're not going to get a second chance. And that's not a uniquely Christian problem. Again, everybody has that fear. The difference is Christians at least try to reckon with it. Other people try to ignore it till they get there. So the story I want to look at today comes from Mark's gospel and is, I think, a beautiful way of explaining how Christians make their peace with death and understand God's victory over. And it comes from Mark chapter 5, beginning in verse 21 through 24. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and alive. And he went with him. Details not to overlook here. Jairus is a man who is described as a ruler of the synagogue. Throughout the gospel record, when you meet somebody who's described as a religious elite, a ruler of the synagogue, how well do they normally get along with Jesus? Not so great. In the gospel, these are the people usually, not universally, but usually kind of on the opposite side of the argument. So here is a man who is powerful, influential, well-respected, has means at his disposal, and probably not terribly fond of Jesus, if we have to guess, who comes to Jesus and falls at his feet. What does that describe? Desperation. It wasn't that he didn't have any other options to try, it's that he'd tried them all. I don't think Jesus was his first doctor. I don't think this was his first attempt. I think this was the Hail Mary at the end of the game. My daughter's not just sick today. She is at the point of death. This is almost over. And I've tried everything else. And now a desperate father does the one thing he probably didn't particularly want to do, which was to go and beg a man he didn't particularly think fondly of, who quite often people in his position were adversarial with, to beg and say, I need you to come. She's at the point of death. And so Jesus picks up and goes with him. In an ordinary gospel account, the next verse would read, and then they arrived at the man's home, and Jesus did something amazing. But what we actually get in Mark, it only happens in Mark's gospel, but he's a master writer in this particular way. Mark likes to interrupt his own stories with another story. Does anybody else tell stories like that? I'm the worst. I'll get started, and I'm telling a story, and then that reminds me, I'm over here, and then like 15 minutes later, what were we talking about? Mark's gospel sometimes reads like that, but it's on purpose, whereas mine is just clueless, meandering. His is on purpose, that he likes to tell you, like when you're watching your favorite show on television and the narrator says, meanwhile, right? Mark will do meanwhile. He'll say, here is something else that was going on. And he puts the two stories next to each other so you can compare them. We could just say, Jairus has a sick daughter, and then let's see what happens. But there's something we need to know about what is going to happen in the life of Jairus that happens along the way. At the end of the road, Jairus and Jesus have to come face to face with the little girl on the brink of death. But in this story, while death's at the end of the road, journey comes before destination. Something has to happen before we get there, and the journey matters. There's a reason. Life matters. That journey of development and growth matters. We don't skip to the ending and say, how's this death thing going to work out? It's the living before we get there. That's what human beings are, these little living changing things. So my friend John reminded me this week, there's a great C.S. Lewis quote that says, we're all just eggs. You hatch or you spoil, right? That all of human life is, you've got to get to the next thing, and the process matters. Growth and change matter. And we get to see a little moment, a little vignette of the life of Jairus before he gets to the end of the road. And it's very powerful. It starts like this. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better but grew worse. See what Mark did? It sounds like he's completely lost track of his story. And by the way, let me now tell you about somebody completely different that was just off in the crowd. Okay? And the woman he describes is a stark opposite of a ruler of a synagogue with lots at his disposal, but they have the same desperation. She's a woman who has an illness that is difficult even to talk about. It's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant, socially taboo, certainly then, to some degree now. I remember we were going to have a lesson on this at a summer series I was putting together at another congregation, and I was trying to put the titles on the little poster, you know, here's the lessons through the summer. What do you call this story? The woman with the issue of bleeding doesn't look good on a flyer. Like, it's just, it's an awkward story to even talk about. But if you think it's awkward to talk about, living it was far, far worse. In her setting, in her time, in her place, in her health, everything about this is bad news for her. And she was desperate, and she had gone to many physicians too. I'm going to nerd out for just a moment because, yes, I went and looked. We do have some existing historical accounts of the sort of things doctors prescribe to women with issues of bleeding in the first century world. They're deeply enlightening. Stand at an intersection and have various people from town come by and try to scare you. It's like she had the hiccups, right? There was another one that involved a chicken, and I can't exactly remember how it went, but let's just say it doesn't work. She was spending everything she had, and those were the well-intended guys. Never mind the charlatans who said, oh, I've got a solution for your cough. I don't have a cough. I have an issue of blood. Oh, yeah, this will work for that too. She spent everything that she had trying to get better, only ends up worse. Not just the same, worse. How desperate is this woman? She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched the hem of his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. Desperation meets faith, and she pushes her way through the crowd and through touch. Why is touch important? Because this is a woman who's not allowed to touch anyone. You know how important human touch is? Did you miss being able to touch other people over the last 15 months? Like, hasn't it been great to just get a hug once in a while? It's kind of wonderful. Human touch matters. This is a woman who is ceremonially unclean. People don't want to touch her. But she reaches out and she touches the rabbi. She touches Jesus as she's passing in the desperate hope that something could be better. Jesus notices. And immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, I have no idea what that means, don't ask me. Perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" That's a silly question. Who touched you? All of these people touched you. What are you talking about? You're in a mob. That's what a mob is, people touching you, whether you like it or not. Jesus says, no. One of them touched me. One of them touched me in faith. One of them was made whole, and I noticed. And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." Are you lost yet? This is a story that began with Jairus and his daughter, and there's no daughter. We haven't even met the daughter. We're like 15 verses in. What Mark is doing is telling you the story that develops along the way, and what you're supposed to remember is that Jairus is still there. Jairus and Jesus are walking down the road together to the house where Jairus' daughter is at the point of death. And along the way, this side incident happens. And someone who is not whole is made whole. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" You see the divine timing in that? At the same instant, Jesus is saying, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole." Someone has come to challenge the faith, the very frail, desperate faith of Jairus, and says there's no reason to come any further with Jesus. Why not wait till he gets there? There's no reason to be seen with Jesus anyway, right? Jairus doesn't have a great relationship with Jesus by any account that we would guess. So, hey, it's over. It's sad. She's gone. It's what Mark is telling us is that Jairus needed the story of the woman on the road before he got home. He needed that story to develop his faith, or he wasn't going to make it home, and he didn't know it. Along the road of life, we encounter other battles which prepare us for the final enemy. I started by saying the scary thing about death is we don't know how the story ends till we get there. But God knew that about us. And so what he does is he gives us little battles along the way. As we're walking down the road, right? We could tell the story of Christianity like this. I believed, and then I died, and I was raised from the dead to be with God, the end. But the way God tells the story is, I believed, and I started living like a Christian, and then something wonderful happened, and then something terrible happened, and then something wonderful happened, and then something terrible happened, and I saw the hand of God in all of it so that when I got to the end of the road, I knew what was going to happen. It's the journey that teaches us what's happening at the end. And you can't skip to the end. You can't skip to the last chapter of the book. You've got to see the journey all along the way. Jairus needed to see this woman he had never met and did not care about, healed by a man he desperately needed to heal himself and his daughter. So Jesus, overhearing what they said, "Forget about it, she's dead." Overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he names it. He says, "This is why we're going down this road. This is why this is happening. You, I know, are afraid. I know you're fearful and full of a lack of faith." I don't think he'd be full of a lack of faith, but he was. "Full of doubt, full of skepticism, and now have been given one more reason to get rid of any faith that you had. Maybe Jesus can heal the sick, but surely he can't heal the dead. Come on home." Jesus says, "No, don't fear. This is the very moment of faith." And Jairus found some The effortless power of Jesus over all of life's enemies helps us to believe he will triumph over the final enemy. That every victory along the way was supposed to teach you something that you needed for the end. There's a reason they put the final exam at the end, because I'm not ready for it yet. I'm not ready for it yet. And I've come closer to glimpses of death in the last year than I ever thought I would. And in my own family, and getting to see sickness and what it looks like, and you thought, huh, that's not the way it's supposed to work. I'm supposed to have more time to figure that out. And you come to grips with it and you say, okay, what am I supposed to get out of this? We learn along the way from the individual battles how to prepare for the ending of the story, and we need them. And so in Mark chapter 5, 38 and following, the story comes to its conclusion. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. And he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. So again, notice the difference. You got three groups of people. One group mourning because she's dead. One group laughing at Jesus and trying to ignore it. And then you got a small little group of people in faith who are going to go to the end of the road. All the way in the house, all the way to the room where the young lady has died. And it's worth the wait. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking. She was 12 years old. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. One of the sweetest healing stories in the entire Bible. A whispered word. Mark even gives it to you because he wants to capture not just what he meant, but the sounds from his lips. A whispered "Talitha kumi." Little girl, stand up. And she does. How did we get there? How did we get to the end of the road? By traveling down the road. By not giving up when we were desperate, but going to Jesus. By not giving up when we were interrupted, but instead seeing that interruption as an opportunity for greater faith. By not giving up when skepticism and doubt said, "It's over, she's dead, there's no reason to go further." By not giving up when we arrive near to the end and someone says, "There's no reason to be here." But it's in the faith that was built along the road. But like the stilling of a storm in a prior chapter, the defeat of death is no more difficult for Jesus than a whisper. I mean, that's the shock. You think he's going to roll up his sleeves and really do something fantastic, and instead he just whispers a word, "Talitha kumi," and it's done. That's maybe the hardest part to believe about all of this. Not just that Jesus is going to defeat death, but that it's going to be easy. The thing we fear the most is effortlessly defeated. Jesus says, "Stand up," and we do. Trumpet sounds and people get up. That it's effortless. That's so hard to believe because death beats us so effortlessly. The idea that someone could be that much stronger is a challenge to believe. And God knew it would be challenging. So all along the way, he gives us the little victories in life that show us Jesus is strong enough to actually conquer death at the end of the story. And that's the point that Paul was making back in that verse we started with in 1 Corinthians 15. Then comes the end. When he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and power, for he must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death, for God has put all things in subjection under his feet. Paul says, "Yeah, I know there's one left, but have you noticed he's already beaten everything else? Have you noticed that nothing else has stood in his way? Have you noticed that everything else has been made subject unto him? Those victories prepare you for the next one." And so we approach it in faith. Jesus is strong enough. He didn't come here and get surprised by death. He went to the cross himself willingly to show us the triumph of Sunday morning, to prepare us for the end of the road. Our job is to walk along with him and learn the lessons along the way. And don't stop before we get there. Would you bow with me in a word of prayer? Our Father and our God, we thank you for this day. And we thank you for the obstacles and the pains of life's journey. We thank you for the opportunities that you gave us, though we did not want them, to learn and to grow and be strengthened by adversity. Help us to see in every victory your guiding hand and wisdom, your power showing us that our faith is warranted. Help us never to give up that faith before the end. Help us to follow you all the way down the road. And help us to hear those whispered victorious words at the end to arise. This we pray in Jesus' name, the first victor over death. Amen.